This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. The Age of Enlightenment dawned on Europe in the 18th century, and France played a central role in its development. It marked a turn toward science and away from superstition. But a discovery by historian Jay Smith shows that superstitions died hard, even among the intelligentsia. Jay teaches history at UNC Chapel Hill. He was doing some research when he came across press accounts of a fantastic beast that terrorized the residents of South Central France in the mid-1700s. One hunter described it as part horse, part lion, and part hyena. The legend drew the attention of everybody from commoners to King Louis XV. The beast of the Gévaudan, as it was known, attacked hundreds of people between 1764 and 1767. Jay Smith doesn't think the creature was much of a mystery. He says the killings were clearly the work of wolves. But the greater question is how French intellectuals and the crown got wrapped up in this myth, and why historians have largely ignored the story. Jay has written a new book called Monsters of the Gévaudan, Making of a Beast, and he's my guest on the program today. Jay, welcome.
Thank
you. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So tell us about the beast of the Gévaudan.
Well, once upon a time, in a remote and rugged region of southern France, a mysterious creature roamed the hillsides, killing scores of shepherds and shepherdesses and other unfortunate peasants. And as word of the beast's ravages spread throughout the Gévaudan and to all corners of France, rumors about its strange appearance and its allegedly supernatural or diabolical characteristics went with the story. And in a matter of a couple of months, urban readers, government officials, elites of all sorts all across France and beyond actually were as engaged in the story and as curious about this monster as the peasants of the Gévaudan.
But it was not unusual for people who were tending livestock to be killed, because ordinarily, as you point out in the book, this was the job of women or young children.
Right.
Right. And this would happen from time to time, wouldn't it?
It did. Right. There were episodes like the killings in the Gévaudan, at least a half a dozen times in the previous century, before the mid-18th century, with very similar characteristics, dozens of people dying, strange descriptions of the monster appearing, even with many of the characteristics of the killings themselves recurring, that is, decapitation and disembowelment and so on, very grisly features of the killings. Yeah, it wasn't really that uncommon. So what's curious about this incident is it became this, national and international publicity phenomenon that it wasn't immediately interpreted as yet another rash of wolf killings.
So a couple of important things to understand about that time period. First of all, there is a press to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps more importantly, as you point out, this was after the disastrous, what the French would call the Seven Years' War, what we know as the French and Indian War.
Right.
Bad news for the French.
Very bad news. In the Seven Years' War, the French lost virtually all of their overseas empire. Their national debt doubled. They lost prestige and standing internationally, both to the British and to the Prussians. It was a very depressing time to be a Frenchman, 1764, 1765. And so the appearance of the beast happened to intersect with this cultural malaise that followed the Seven Years' War. And it impacted the unfolding of the story in interesting ways.
So, and one of them is that the king is going to take this story seriously and do something about it.
That's right. That's right. It was a new opportunity for Louis XV to assert his paternal care for the beleaguered population of the Gévaudan and by extension all of France. And so he got very visibly – he and the royal court in general got very visibly engaged in the story early in 1765.
And it reads like a fairy tale in a way. The king has a problem. He puts out the word and three hunters come in succession to try to kill the beast. I mean, that's how it happened, right?
That's right. That's right.
And tell us about the hunters, because they're kind of fascinating too.
They really are. It's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book. They and several of the government officials on the ground in the Gévaudan are just fascinating personalities. Each of the three lead huntsmen who came in succession were noblemen, but they came at the story and they came to their task with somewhat different motives. and different experiences and perspectives. The first lead huntsman, Duhamel, Jean-Baptiste Duhamel, was a veteran of the Seven Years' War and one who had worked closely with and benefited from the patronage of the supreme commander of the French army during the Seven Years' War. And it's clear that if you read his letters closely, that he regarded the hunt for the beast as an opportunity to reclaim lost honor. His language is just saturated with references to gallantry and status and standing, and this desire to reassert his own standing and the standing of his army and of his commander is a driving force throughout his 5 months on the job. It's just fascinating.
He didn't succeed.
He did not.
So go ahead. You're going to tell us about. Let's hear about the other two.
Yeah. The other two are also nobles, but very different characters. The Norman huntsman Jean-Marc Donneval was reputed to be the greatest wolf hunter of the age. Certainly, the greatest wolf hunter from the province of Normandy, and possibly from the entire realm. And he was sent with his son in February of 1765 to take over for Duhamel, who had failed so miserably. And he shows up on the scene and almost instantly alienates everybody in the region. He's arrogant. He's very rude toward other notables and other noble seigneurs in the region. He spends the first several weeks there on the ground in the Gévaudan trying to get exclusive control over the hunting operations. And once he gets them, he just proceeds to bumble his way through the late spring and early summer, finding no wolves at all. He kills not a single wolf during his 3 months on the job. So he just turned out to be a buffoon. And his story is it's fascinating just to see how the locals reacted to him and how they dealt with their disillusionment after his arrival.
So there's two of the three, but I want to stop you there because these guys now are having to report back. They've got to kill the beast in order to for whatever, but mostly for their own reputation. There is no beast. They have to report something. And that's part of the interesting story here is their reports back to the king about how they're doing and what it is they think they're seeing or hearing about in the field.
Yeah. That's right. With the exception of Duhamel, who is alleged to have seen the beast once or twice, none of the hunters really got a good look at this creature, and yet they in their correspondence, both to the king, to the ministers, to provincial officials in Montpellier, they report on alleged sightings. They report the hearsay that they've picked up in the field from peasants and village consuls and others in the region, and even Antoine, the last of the three hunters, who is initially very skeptical of the beast's story and assumes that it will in fact turn out to be a wolf, even Antoine remains very open to the possibility that he will eventually encounter an extraordinary creature. And I think the only way to explain this, the fact that these very experienced huntsmen on the ground in this southern province for a little over a year, continued to believe to accept the possibility that there was this extraordinary creature out there in the woods, is that the only way to explain it is that they had been absorbing the public discourse about this creature that was coming from the newspapers and coming from naturalists and coming from religious figures. And they essentially got caught up in the hysteria along with everyone else.
Started to believe their own, the descriptions and take them on as their own. At one point, one of the hunters, I think, described what he had heard about the beast, and a few weeks later, he embraced it, and it became his eyewitness account.
That's right, exactly. This is Duhamel, the first person on the job. He talked to a 40-year-old peasant woman who was attacked, or at least allegedly attacked by the beast, I think December 20th, 1764. She provided him with a very fantastic description of this creature. Talons like a razor and an extremely long tail and the longest fangs she'd ever seen and so on. But a few days later, Duhamel himself tells us, at least told his friends and other correspondents on December 24th, that he himself had seen the beast and just missed shooting it dead But in that correspondence, he doesn't say anything about its strange characteristics. He doesn't provide an unusual description of this animal. And yet a few weeks later, he has adopted this the peasant woman's description as well.
So it really has a hold on the imagination. The book is Monsters of the Gévaudan. The author is Jay Smith, a history professor at UNC Chapel Hill. And part of the reason for that is this a press. There is a thriving press that finds these stories fascinating.
That's right. That's right. The 18th century is, in a way, the place where we tend to mark the birth of modernity, and of the many modern institutions that emerge out of the 18th century, a thriving journalism is one of them. And a number of these editors, reporters who relayed news of the beast had recognized earlier in the 1740s and 50s that if you don't have a good war to sell, if there aren't casualties you can report and heroic battles that you can report on, the best thing you can do to sell papers is seize on one of these weird stories from everyday life or human interest stories or tales of the supernatural, whatever. If you have interesting stories like that that you can insert in your dry political accounts, which make up the bulk of the paper, that will help you sell copies. And the Courrier d'Avignon, which was the principal newspaper that flogged the story of the beast, was led by a very inventive entrepreneurial editor who recognized the value of this story and had recognized the value of other stories like it in the decades leading up to the early 1760s, and who was just one of the real innovators in this genre of the human interest story.
Human interest story. And we know the press was thriving. Certainly in North America, it fueled the American Revolution, but we tend to think in terms of political discourse on these broadsides, so that the idea of the human interest story, complete with fantastic drawings, is sort of refreshing to kind of imagine that scene. And people gathered around the squares in the big cities reading these stories aloud.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. So not only that, so you've got the press. I mean, imagine this. Can you imagine a national leader whose country is in tatters, who's left the nation in ruin, and then takes a small threat and builds it into a big threat just to get everybody's attention off how he messed up the country? That's crazy. That could only happen in the 18th century, couldn't it? And only in France. And then a press that would seize on it and not ask any questions but figure it must be the real deal.
Right.
Gosh,
right.
I'm glad that's over. But also the intelligence. Intelligentsia latched on this as well. And this, again, this period, this threshold moment, right, in Western history where we cross over from the old regime into the new. Mm-hmm. And what a snapshot this is of sort of trying to let go of these myths. But talk about the intelligentsia, because they were not this wasn't just story from the common folk.
That's true. That's right. The elites collaborated with the peasantry on a variety of levels throughout the whole episode to create this fantastic image. And we've talked a little bit about the Seven Years' War and the hangover left over in 1764 as a result of that disastrous conflict for the French. But there's also scientific discourse of the 1750s and 60s that helped to contribute to the making of the beast, because for decades before the appearance of this terrible monster, naturalists and what we today would call scientists had debated the nature of the monster and what monstrous births and monstrous bodies could tell us about the course of nature and how monsters were or were not to be separated from the normal biological forms with which they were familiar. The appearance of the beast in 1764 and 1765 immediately connected with this already existing discourse, curiosity about monsters and exotic creatures that had been created by elites working in academies and at the king's botanical garden. It was natural that this story would resonate among that crowd, that it would fall on ears primed to receive it.
And it's not just a sideshow as far as you're concerned, and I think anybody who reads this might think the same thing. I'm going to read just the last sentence of your book. The context in which Devenol, who is one of the hunters, imagined his mysterious and maddening enemy has now vanished, right? But the record shows that 1764 to 1765, a great configuration of elites, skeptics among them, took the beast and its world very seriously indeed. Students who wish to understand the French old regime and the shape of the modern world that emerged from it should follow their lead. Why? What does this story tell us about that moment?
Well, it tells us that that there is a kind of a myth of modernity that was constructed on the ruins of the beast's story in the late 18th century, which represents all of the bearers of modernity, the Enlightenment figures, rational administrators, and so on, as being always perfectly rational and immune to superstition, immune to strange beliefs, and so on. But in fact, it's quite clear that in the middle of the 1760s, people like that, even though they were in many ways enlightened and forward-looking and modern and modernizing in all sorts of ways, also still had one foot in a kind of, you know, vaguely medieval world of wonders and amazement, and they were still subject to superstition, and to superstitious beliefs. So this suggests that the emergence of the modern world in the 19th century is perhaps a bit more complicated than we generally like to imagine, and is usually represented in textbooks about the period, for example.
How about the beast? Gone forever, or has it been cited since?
It has not been cited, but there's a lot of discussion about the beast still, especially in France, although it is usually taken to be a kind of unsolved mystery that invites conspiracy theorists and believers in the supernatural, specialists in the paranormal and that sort of thing. So there are still many theories about the beast's identity.
Jay, thank you so much for being in the program today.
Thank you, Frank.
Jay Smith is a history professor at UNC Chapel Hill and author of Monsters of the Gévaudan, Making of the Beast. That's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.